Right. And this particular gentleman began to talk about the Manson arrest in Los Angeles at Topanga Canyon at the Spahn Ranch, where he was in on the arrest of Charlie Manson. And about 3 weeks ago, Gloria, we made a tape here on just the Sharon Tate massacre. You remember that?
Right.
And it was a landmark case, I think, in news affairs, in newsbreak, because nobody had publicly stated until that date that the Sharon Tate killings were a political massacre. And I had studied them for 2 years. And whenever I talk about the killing of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, I throw in the LaBianca, Sharon Tate, Jay Sebring, Folger, the whole massacre of the seven people as being a political thing for the reason that it was done to come down on a class of society called hippie. That the hippie was no different than chasing the black, which had been going on for years, and coming down on them. And that the purpose was to discredit this group across the country and to effect an election which was to take place in our state, to affect pressures for law and order, and to come down, mistrust these young people, don't give them rides, don't house them, and disassociate yourself. They're violent. And I saved the evidence of Charlie Manson and who he was seeing, or the lawyers he and Charles Watson were seeing. And Manson, to me, was a political patsy. He did not kill the people in those two homes that evening. He may have murdered other people. I have no evidence of earlier murders, but I know he didn't do those. And he was no different than Oswald or Ray or Sirhan in terms of being a patsy for a purpose. The one-hour show, I hope, can you redo it someday?
Yes, I think we should.
If there's no earth-shattering news, maybe next week in place of this broadcast, could you redo the Manson one?
Yeah, I'll have to dig out the tape, yeah.
Because it's very, very important to the local news that we talk about all the time. Well, this particular gentleman that spoke to the community meeting, that saw that community meeting, mentioned that the Sheriff's Department in Los Angeles had full knowledge of Charles Manson weeks prior to the killings, and that local people were complaining that they had machine guns, that they were making a lot of noise, and there was shooting and military type of practicing out there, and they wanted them arrested, and there was every reason to arrest Charlie Manson and the group of people that were at his ranch, 30 or 40 people. He was out on parole. He had been charged with slavery. Earlier, he had a girl who was underage. The father dropped the arrest charge, but he was on parole, so the sheriff could have kept Manson in because he had a minor with him. They knew they had all kinds of heavy drugs, narcotics, and so forth. They had machine guns and weapons, and he was on parole. And every time a sheriff made a report on Manson or a memo, the order came out, you don't touch Manson. This was for weeks before the Sharon Tate murder. You don't touch Manson. And they were not allowed to make an arrest. They said, well, why don't we go in here? Here's this guy's at Spahn Ranch. And they had an obligation to the citizens in the area who said there's an outlaw motorcycle gang, violent people, weapons going around. And the police department, the sheriff's department, would not touch him. And the citizens were subjected to whatever terror would come down on them. They didn't know what was happening. And the memo said, you don't touch Manson. But some stolen car parts were missing a week after the Sharon Tate murder, and they brought in Manson and all the girls and Watson into jail for 3 days, and they let them out. This was after the murder. And they could have had him then on all these other charges, on the narcotics, the slavery, and they took machine guns away in this arrest. It took two helicopters. The gentleman gave the account that 1 week after the killings, we made a raid. He said at Spahn Ranch on a Saturday morning, they made a dawn raid, and they hit it with 102 deputies, and all the regular deputies were out except a very few. And they had two helicopters, 30 radio cars, everything they could muster. They came up with 13 weapons, two of which were automatic, handguns, machine guns, and so forth. But they let Charlie go, and he went out to the Barker Ranch and disappeared because the people in the neighborhood were having a fuss, and he went out. And he said just the logistics of moving 30 or 40 people out to the Barker Ranch, where they had all their facilities and they were taken care of. And they were not picked up by the Los Angeles Police Department at all. It was, again, on stealing a car part or something. Now, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that the legal departments in the city of Los Angeles, California, were waiting for Charlie Manson to kill. Now, the particular man who worked in the department said he thought that they had foreknowledge of their intelligence gathering. They had intelligence report all the time, every day, coming on Charlie Manson. He was to kill black people, Black Panthers. And then the L.A. Police Department would look clean because they'd find the killer and the Panthers would be wiped out. So the law enforcement people did not protect blacks, you know, if this was what it was to be. Now, this particular man was completely stupefied because he only knew what was happening, how you would arrest a man and they let him go, or how they wanted to arrest him and they wouldn't let him. And I said that because I followed the overthrow of Greece and the way they came down on the hippies and in 1967, and then Kaiser putting out his report on hippies done by non-hippies in this area and saying they were violent, that I was waiting for something to come down on that class of people. And that what I knew was that Manson was allowed to happen. He was allowed to happen. So my research into political assassinations goes very deep, and it covers many years. And it continues every day. And then when you go to a meeting, not expecting to hear anything like this, but to hear problems about your local area and saw that, and a man comes and says, "You won't believe this story." It just really blew my mind. And, of course, the police officials right away were going to put this man down. "This isn't true. It doesn't happen." I said, "Now, wait a minute. I've done this research," and out of the woods came this person he didn't even know existed. He didn't know anyone in the United States was doing any research into the Sharon Tate murders as being a political thing. And then he disclosed that the Special Enforcement Bureau of the Sheriff's Department, the same group, the political branch of that group, was the one that went up to Santa Barbara to help with the Isla Vista, that clubbed the kids, that did the real hurting, that made the scene, that made the headlines, the agent provocateurs, the smell of the students, the radicals, the blood. That branch, not the Santa Barbara police. The Santa Barbara police get a bad name. The students get a bad name. The state gets a bad name. The Special Enforcement Bureau was the group that went right up to Isla Vista. So there are political branches of the law enforcement agencies, and these things have to be cleared out. This is where the conspiracy lies. If you say you talk every week about conspiracies, name places. I'm telling you that every branch of every law enforcement agency has its own tax squad, special squad, conspiracy group, and when these murders come down, they handle the investigation, they collect the evidence, they plant the evidence. They are the group, like in Los Angeles that Lewis Tackwood talked about, they are the special branches that take care of all the conspiracies and the provocateurs. Now, yesterday, Gloria, I found in the Mercury, San Jose Mercury, an article which is so pertinent that I'm going to use the remaining time of this show to talk about it.
Yes, I read that one yesterday.
Did you read it?
Yes.
This is supposed to be the swan song of the ego of American youth, the finale to John Kennedy. And I might say, as I talk about the article, that one suggestion to make is that if the young people would get some of the records of John Kennedy, which should be in the library or buy them at the record stores, I own some of his speeches, because that name is gone for these people who don't remember who he was. We're studying political assassinations, and these young people have lost their ego and their hope. If they would get these records and listen to what John Kennedy said and his voice and the content of his material, and then play a speech of Richard Nixon alongside of it, his recent speeches, or the records, if there are, of Richard Nixon speeches, then you would know what was lost in the last 8 years. The only thing way you know what you lost is if you see the difference. If you go to New Woolworths and you buy a diamond ring and you're down building a sandcastle and it falls off, you won't miss it unless you've had a ring from Tiffany. I'm not saying John Kennedy was Tiffany, but you have to get an authentic feeling of somebody trying to effect changes in society, and the sincerity or the program that intended to be put into effect that barely got started. And you have to know what you lost to make a comparison. But the New York Times came out with an article, unsigned, of course. I would love to know who wrote it, called "Youth's Great Ego Trip is Fading Out." Now, if there was one thing we can't afford to lose in any time or any place or any hour of our day, it's our ego. When that's gone, you are in great trouble. And I'm going to read part of the article, and I'm going to make remarks about it as we go along. And I want to explain what they're trying to say. The gist of the article is that the hopes of the kids in the 60s and the excitement is over. Who are your heroes? Who do you admire? There aren't any. You can't find individuals with heroes anymore. The youth revolution has turned sour. They're disinterested in Vietnam. They're disinterested in the draft lottery. Students are relaxing. Their sorrows are deep. And we'll take some of the sentences of this article. The conclusion was that they have survived a lot of crises like war and assassinations and riots and demonstrations. And now they're settling down for individual interests and pleasures. And the spread of marijuana is helping them settle down. And you have lost your ego. You have your marijuana. Take it easy, kids. The fight is over. This is like the burial of the hippie at Haight-Ashbury. They buried it too soon, because it isn't over. The hippie's alive, and so are the youth. And like Tinkerbell was alive and Peter Pan, we're just going to have to do a lot of clapping to keep it going. They're trying to bury you, but don't let them, please. Talking about marijuana, Lewis Tackwood in Los Angeles, the policeman for 10 years who turned informer, mentioned that he charged the Los Angeles Police Department had allowed narcotics to be sold in black and Chicano communities to create a dependency on the drug and to undercut political movement. And I know that your campuses here are filled with drugs. MPC is filled with opium right now and cocaine and heavy drugs. Not so much the psychedelic things to turn you away from anything that is happening. The students out there in Carmel got excited about the artichoke farm and saving the Odella farm. This is another local thing where they generate enthusiasm. The high school people work very hard on that. But I think the college people and above are walking artichokes. I think we should turn on to those people and say, you have been turned into an artichoke. Their heads are gone. And most of them are spaced out on drugs, and the campuses all over the country are completely freaked out on drugs. And the evidence is coming in that the agencies are supplying it. And this can be documented. And I know the CIA is bringing drugs and opium in from Asia, and Iran is growing it again, our great ally Iran and Turkey. And I think there's a positive intention to flood the campuses. There's no arrest being made, and they're going to flood the campuses. You can get opium at MPC today if you want it and not be arrested. It's available to anybody who wants it. I understand that that campus is almost as heavily drugged as any campus in the United States. The student was over who helps me do filing my articles. I met through the station, and she went to Antioch and a year and a half, and she said she dropped out of there because it was so heavily doped. You couldn't relate the students to anything that was going on. And she asked, you know, the man who ran the university, why is this happening? And every university is losing its fight and fire because there is an intention to dope these students and make them very quiet. Now, this article in the New York Times says, in quotes, the great youth trip, that heady, sometimes breathtaking, frightening roller coaster ride that went through the late years of the 60s and plunged headlong into this decade, is almost slowing down and may be almost over. 2 or 3 years ago, the administration of Stanford University called in a group of students and said, who are your heroes? Who do you really admire? End quote. This is interesting because whenever I talk to people, any people, I say, who are your heroes? Who do you admire? And people today don't have heroes. And I may take time out from the article to suggest a few heroes. The police informer, Lewis Tackwood, I think he should be a hero. The one in Los Angeles who for 10 years helped commit crimes and plant false evidence on people and help do very bad not information on Berkeley City Council. It was none of the business of the Los Angeles Police Department. Quit the Los Angeles Police Department because it was to plant bombs in San Diego at the time of the 72 election and blow up the people who would plant the bombs and kill well-known congressmen and news people. He's a hero. He has saved a lot of lives by saying, no, I won't do it. I won't go into that. He charged the Los Angeles Police Department of planning disturbances at the National Convention in San Diego, and the disturbances would give the president a good issue for the campaign and provide an excuse for rounding up known militants across the country. He resigned after 10 years and risked his life and is in hiding. He should be a hero. If you want to know who your heroes are and you think life is hopeless, you young people, read your San Francisco Chronicle this week. A young sheriff named Richard Hengisto was just elected last Tuesday, and he's going to collect information on the police department. He says the San Francisco Police Department kills too many people. They have guns on their hips, and they use their deadly force, and they have a bad habit of letting their men shoot their people. Mr. Hengisto said this week that he's going to make improvements to save the taxpayers' money in the criminal justice department, and he's going to listen to complaints against other departments, including the police. And he said, I will have a staff with a lot of experience with law enforcement, and they will provide information on police, on the work of the law. And when we see problems, we are going to be obliged to inform the public. This is a young man who ran for election and beat all the other people running, who offered one-third of his salary to put back to the poor part of town if he won, to listen to their problems. What Mr. Hengisto said, the judges don't like the ideas that I'm going to say, and that's too bad. I'm not going to sit by idly while the taxpayers' money is being wasted on unused courtrooms. It's time to fill those courtrooms. He said, I'm going to work to ease the mutual feeling of hostility and fear and tension that exists between the jailers and the inmates, and I'm going to do away with acts of excessive force by inmates or deputies. It will not be tolerated. And he will bring the jails up to minimum standards of sanitation and health and diet. And we're going to begin treating people with dignity and cut down recidivism. Now, Sheriff-elect Richard Hengisto is not out on opium or hash or any other thing. He has listed the problems in his society. He has recruited people behind him who believe in him. He ran for office and he won. Now, there aren't many sheriffs like that in the United States, but they could be in every city in 2 years, every election, if the young people would not believe what the New York Times is telling you or the local newspaper, that your heroes are gone. Your heroes are walking the streets. Another hero this week is Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Hebert. He was accused of telling his superiors about atrocities in Vietnam. The Army has been hassling him since he got home. And this is what Mr. Hebert said.
Herbert.
The Army has dropped charges against Mr. Herbert, who is America's most decorated soldier in Korea. Mr. Herbert said the following, quote, on the field of battle, as an enlisted man as an officer, I have served to the best of my ability. And in that service, I have been shot 5 times and bayoneted 3 times, and none of which was as painful for me as the decision I announced. For 2.5 years, I have struggled to help the Army eliminate the stigma of concealment of war crimes, which I personally saw and had the knowledge of, and the actions taken by certain members of the Army at the local and Pentagon level convinced me that to continue seeking correction within the military would be useless, end quote. He is our most decorated hero of Korea. He has served in Vietnam. He cannot work within the system. So when I speak to you about cover-ups, political assassinations, murder of candidates, we can unsolve these murders outside of their system, but in our own system. We can create our own system, like the sheriff in San Francisco or Mr. Herbert or other. He'll be Mr. Herbert. He won't be Lieutenant Colonel. There is a generative force of people to want to live and do good, and I want to rally the people, Gloria, to see that there are heroes today. Don't believe your heroes.
Ellsberg is another hero.
Ellsberg is right. I was going to read a quotation. June 25th, 1971, when Ellsberg spoke about why he released the Pentagon Papers. He said, there's never been a year when there would have been a war in Indochina without American money fueling it. If we had not been supplying the money and the napalm, nothing would have gone on that looked like a war. Americans bear major responsibility. As I read this history of every death in Indochina in the last 25 years, and that's 1 to 2 million people. Ellsberg was asked in reading the history if he found any heroes among his protagonists. In quotes, I think of the man named Bernard who put down his rifle on the ground at the risk of his life and refused orders to fire at civilians at My Lai. He's a hero, but it's hard to find men who've lived up to their responsibilities of their office in terms not only what they did, but what they could have done and what they should have done. given their feelings. End quote. Signed, Daniel Ellsberg. So, you see, I've mentioned heroes today. Lewis Tackwood in Los Angeles, saving lives. He's done wrong. He's seen the light. Mr. Hungies in San Francisco, Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Herbert, Daniel Ellsberg. Don't be put down that there are not heroes.
I nominate Mae Bressel also.
Thank you, Gloria. I'm in the fire line. I'm in the battle. It has to be done, and it's something you do because you feel it's important. And there's unsung heroes. There's a silent majority that Nixon talks about. I think the silent majority are the decent people who will rally behind what's really happening and bring out the basic goodness. I never accepted the doctrine of original sin. My church-going listeners may object to my saying this. This isn't a religious program. There's original goodness, and it's in the news every week. I bring you things of gloom. I'm bringing you the heroes because I resent this article. If I don't have time to read the whole article, I will begin with the fact that they put you down. You have no heroes. I'm reading you five heroes in this week's news since we met last week. The last one I want to talk is a suit by the Civil Liberties Union that a landmark case on the computer's invasion of privacy where two women who work in the State Department of Social Welfare refuse to disclose confidential information about welfare recipients to be included into computer data bank. It's a landmark case. These two women, their names aren't in the paper. Oh, yes, they are. Josephine Belmont and Glenda Pawsey, two women back east, refuse to pass over information for a data bank, and the Civil Liberties Union is taking care of it. It's in Pennsylvania. The Civil Liberties Union that takes its time and energy with no money to fight a cause, to defend these women. They keep their job. They were working for welfare people, and they refuse to turn over this information that it's an invasion of privacy, and they are winning this case. Those are your heroines, Josephine Belmont and Glenda Pawsey. They say it's none of your business to put it into a data bank. That is a hero. Another hero is the Supreme Court this week that upheld the right of inmates in the jails to have their own law books. The court ruled in Washington that prison officials may not limit inmates' access to law books. That happened this week. That is a fair law. I don't say the system is all bad. Now get the law books to the inmates. Donate some of your money. You may have jailhouse lawyers, and they have the right to know what the law books say. In California, it was a very important case because we were trying to keep these prisoners from having law books. Brilliant men like Rochelle McGee that are given the IQ test of being somewhat close to an idiot. The man who gave the test just must be lower. You can imagine what his IQ is because Rochelle McGee is a very brilliant, capable young person. But this is a landmark case. Again, they may defend themselves, and convicts can read their law books just as good as any lawyer went to law school. They have the same intellect and the same capacity to understand a law book as a person in the law profession, and they have the right to read that law book. So when you're talking about heroes,
yeah,
you see how much has happened this week. Just this week. I'm cross-filing some of my articles now and cutting out what's important in the news each week. And if I have to put it under filing sections, I'm putting it under other envelopes and not losing the articles because things are coming in so fast now. Well, back to this article as much as we have time.
No, we have about 5 minutes.
Okay. The article goes to say that the students are going changes because they say the war in Vietnam is less visible. We don't have time to refute that statement. The war in Vietnam escalated this week. There were more bombings, heavier bombings, more money allocated to defense, more weapons ordered, more overcharge of weapons. The war is far from over. They say the draft lottery is accepted by the students because it's more equitable. People weren't objecting that the draft was unfair, not the students, because the students were getting draft deferments. Maybe the poor people were saying the draft was unfair. They were objecting to the unfairness of the war. The article is perverting the whole reason for the draft lottery argument. They said the draft is unfair because the war is wrong. They didn't want the war. They didn't. The students don't want fairness and draft system. They just don't want the war for anybody. Then they say the young are changing their attitudes because the 18-year-old vote is a reality. The reality is that they're going to choose between Bomber Jackson and Richard Nixon. That is no reality, and the students better wake up to the fact that this is a put-on. This is a joke. We've talked about Henry Jackson before, that he is the man Richard Nixon wanted for the Secretary of War, but he was so far right that there may be controversy, so he chose Laird. Now, Bomber Jackson is trying to pass himself off as a liberal, and we don't have time. I cut out an article about him this week on how he would run his campaign, that the war was the last issue. The escalation of the war and the arms is so big that he calls it the last. The article says that changes are taking place with the young people, that their solutions have generally narrowed down to what they can do as individuals at a local level. I have to tell you students who didn't read the article that they're thinking that you're caring, like the Amchipka thing, your shore out here or your artichoke field. You better just say to them back in Washington that the local level isn't quite good enough for you, that while you save your green belt, you save your skin, that the national level is very much your concern and the candidates they select for you are very much your concern. And don't believe that they're going to keep you at some local level. You can work at the local level and get your sheriffs like in San Francisco, but you better know your national level, and I'll tell it to you each week until time runs out. Now they say that radicalism isn't existing anymore. It's not paraded in the streets. That is a fact. It should never have been paraded in the streets. When the people in the Tsarist Russia wanted to overthrow an unfair regime, they didn't have meetings at Madison Square Garden and tell the Tsar what they were going to do. If this government has been overthrown, which it was, the only way you're going to gain it back is to gather information and listen to shows like this and take tapes, which many people are doing, and don't invite me over. You play tapes for your friends and send them across the states, which you are doing, and send them to Rhode Island and Florida and Texas and Michigan, where people are sending these tapes, and let them call in their own friends and have their own discussion groups. And get this going at a small level with no leader. The cult thing is over. And you work at your own level and listen to these things and begin to move, because when it becomes big, your leaders are taken away. I can't take you to Madison Square Garden and talk about this. You have to take it yourself. Right. You have to talk about it at home. So the radical days on the street are over. The article says that youths are becoming tolerant. This is the way they describe you: patient, tolerant, cynical, skeptical, apathetic, and subdued. All of this is true. You're patient with anything. You're tolerant of misinformation. You're cynical about people who offer you truth. You're skeptical that anything can be done. You're apathetic because you're drugged and uninformed, and you're subdued because you're uninformed and apathetic and skeptical and cynical and overdrugged. And you just better put down your weeds and grass and put away some of the recreations until you have this country back where it's safe, because you'll belong to the slave state and you will be kept where they want you if you become a victim of the medicine they're pouring into your systems. The adults, too, they are drugged. They have a television lobotomy, I call it. Their brain was removed by CBS.
Right.
Did you have something to say?
No, I think we've got to wrap it up, though, really quick.
Okay. I think that the San Jose Mercury, November the 8th, 1971, if you copy that article on youth's great ego trip fading and outline it and analyze what they're saying, you may rally to see how hard they are trying to put down what's left of any young spirit today. And then you'll see how America's put down, too, and how America has to come back alive.
Thank you, May.
You've been listening to Dialogue. Dialogue is a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News.